This is Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. Scientists at the University of British Columbia may have identified a new population of orcas, also known as killer whales, feeding in the deep waters off the coasts of Oregon and California. The researchers reviewed photos, videos, and descriptions of encounters from fishermen, NOAA scientists, and others over a span of nearly 25 years. They concluded that in terms of behavior and appearance, this group of killer whales is distinct from any of the known populations. Andrew Trites is a professor and the director of the Marine Mammal Research Unit at the University of British Columbia. He is a co-author of the study, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
When did you first hear about this group of orcas that might be a new and previously unknown population?
Well, it's been brewing for quite a few years. In fact, the lead author is Josh McGinnis. He's a graduate student with me here at the University of British Columbia. And he was working on a catalog of killer whales off the coast of California and Oregon. And in building this catalog, he was able to identify most of the individuals as having been associated with each other and been seen regularly, and they all kind of fit together. But then he had this essentially like a shoebox of unknown individuals. In fact, there were 49 whales that didn't quite look like the others. Nobody had seen them consistently, and they became our mystery whales. And it was only in, as Josh was coming to me to puzzle over this, that I began to realize he was onto something. These were, in fact, different than the others and likely a unique and unknown population of killer whales.
Unique from which ones? I mean, what are the already identified populations of killer whales off the northwest coast of North America?
Yeah, we have three different ecotypes, and we call them ecotypes at this point, not species. Sometimes we think of them as being populations, but one of them only eats fish. We refer to them as being resident killer whales. And they specialize particularly in salmon, and not just any salmon. They love Chinook salmon, the biggest of all. The second group, we call them transients or big killer whales, and they were named in part because they always seem to be on the move, and they only eat other marine mammals. And then we have this third group that lives far offshore over the continental shelf. We call them the oceanics, and they appear to be specializing in eating sharks and large fish. And part of the clue in terms of recognizing that they eat sharks is because their teeth are ground down, literally like they've been eating sandpaper. So those are the three known ecotypes. They've been photographed. They're fairly well understood, although we know more about the ones that live closest to shore and less about the ones further away. And now we have this fourth group, and we're not quite sure who they are. If they belong to distant ancestors of the transients because they eat marine mammals, or if they can be a standalone. At this point, we don't know.
So I'm curious about the process of putting the photos of these orcas, these killer whales, into that sort of mystery shoebox. How would your grad student even know who these various orcas are in the first place?
It's a special skill, and there's only a few people, I think, that are really up to this task. And literally, it's like trying to identify somebody just by looking at their fingerprints. Of course, now we have AI. It's going to allow almost anybody on the water that takes a picture to figure out who they're looking at. But Josh is one of these individuals who can recognize everything from the subtleties of the shape of a dorsal fin, the nicks and marks on it, the shapes of the saddle patches, that sort of a grayish white area just behind the dorsal fin, and also looking at the eye patches, these white oval shapes near the eye. And they are just as unique as the fingerprints on your hands.
Who took these various photos that then he would sift through?
Pictures come in from all sorts of sources, and often it's it could be just somebody out on a whale-watching boat. It could be somebody in their own pleasure boat, or we've got them being taken during research cruises. And for the most part, people will take a picture, and then they send it to somebody that's a known killer whale expert, and with one question, like, who are these individuals? We all want to know a bit more about their stories. And with killer whales, it's now possible with time to identify every single animal and give it a name. And not only that, we can then put them into family trees. We can see who's related to who. Who are the grandmas? Who are the aunts and uncles? Who are the cousins? And how they're interrelated. So over the years, this incredibly diverse story has been evolving. And now we have, in essence, family albums of killer whales. Hmm.
Two things come to mind about that. One, just how extraordinary it is that we that humans have such familiarity with members of this species. The other is I can't help but think that part of that is only possible because there are so few of them.
No, you're exactly right. There are a few of them. And, you know, we're talking overall probably less than 1,000. And the fact is that they do get noticed. And to our eyes, we can pick up these subtle differences as well. So it's not quite like looking, I don't know, maybe at a harbor seal, for example.
Which is more anonymous.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the one thing that is interesting here is that if you go back to the 60s and 70s, when killer whales were being captured here off the coast of Washington and British Columbia and being sent to aquariums, nobody recognized that there were different types of killer whales. As far as anybody knew, it was one species. They were all the same. They were called killer whales because they were killers of whales. But of course, it turns out now, well, some are completely piscivores. They only eat fish, and others are specializing in sharks, and others are specializing in, well, they're all specialized. And they've got different structures in terms of their social organizations, feeding habitats, dialects. And really, they are as unique as, I guess, different populations of people around the world.
So, and given that, I guess it's now been a few decades where scientists like you have started to identify and recognize these distinct ecotypes, these distinct populations, what went through your mind when your grad student came to you and said, I think this is actually a new one. This is a distinct and separate population. I mean, I guess the short version of my question is, did you believe him?
You know, I think part of the process in science is initially to be a skeptic and to challenge what's being said, and then putting the onus back to let's put the pieces together. But as we went through it and looked at all the different reports that had come in, the photos as well, I was convinced, as were the other seven people who are co-authors here, that we were onto something unique. And it was time then to announce it, that this is something that's occurred over 24 years. We've had 49 photographs. And there's something going on here, but it's in a piece of the ocean that is so far from shore that so few people have gone out. And literally, if we were to go today to go look for them, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. It's a huge body of water to cover, but there are people out there and people are encountering them. In fact, since our papers come out, we've had about another 20 photographs been sent our way saying, oh, by the way, we saw something. We didn't know this might be important. What do you think?
And does that new data that you've gotten, does it corroborate what you already had or complicate it?
So far, it's consistent with what we've been saying. They do look similar to these other ones, but again, it's going to take more time. And ultimately, we're going to need some DNA, some genetic evidence as well, to really sort out their evolutionary branch and how they're connected to the other killer whales that inhabit our waters.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking right now with Andrew Treitz. He is a co-author of a new study put together by a team of researchers. They say that they have identified a new population of orcas, of killer whales, in the deep waters off the coasts of Oregon and California. Andrew Treitz is the director of the Marine Mammal Research Unit at the University of British Columbia. So as you noted, you started with skepticism, a necessary component of effective, meaningful science. What were the different parts of the evidence that made you believe that this was a distinct population?
Well, there's a few things in here. One would be just their physical appearance. And well, to the average person, it looks just like a killer whale. And there's no doubt that it is a killer whale. They have similarities with the transient type ecotype as well as with the offshore ecotype. And so they look like almost like a hybrid of the two. So that was one thing. Another was where they were seen. It was in really deep waters. And for the most part, they were seen off of the continental shelf break, which is this huge plateau until it drops off into the abyss. And the species they were feeding on were sperm whales, pygmy sperm whales, leatherback turtle. We had one encounter, rhesus dolphin, elephant seal. So big, big animals that they're feeding on, you know, enough to feed a family and even with, and had leftovers. And probably one of the most curious things of all was seeing that 46 of the 49 animals, this is 95% of them, had cookie cutter shark marks on them. So cookie cutter sharks live in tropical waters. They are a parasite, which means they feed off of other species, but don't kill them. And in this case here, these cookie cutters appear to be latching on with their upper teeth onto the body of a swimming killer whale. And then they use their lower teeth to pull out or scoop out this mouth-sized chunk of flesh and blubber. And to our eyes, you see both the scars as well as the holes, literally like someone took a cookie cutter to punch it out of the animal. So 95% have got cookie cutter shark marks, which is an indication that, well, we see, well, the animals we were seeing were reported in Oregon and Washington waters, sorry, Oregon and California waters. They are, in fact, spending time in more tropical waters as well, so maybe coming up here more seasonally. We just don't know yet. But that's one thing that makes them stand out as being really different from the other whales that we're familiar with.
You know, you were talking earlier about, for the other populations, the ability of scientists to know about the families, about the social structures, about the relations. Do you know anything like that for this group?
Not a whole lot, other than they seem to be in fairly large groups. And so if you look at the ecotype, the transients or bigs, killer whales that feed in close to shore on seals and sea lions, for example, they tend to be in twos, threes, and fours. And these groups were seeing, well, we had one encounter. It was 12 killer whales taking on 9 female sperm whales. And later on, the group grew to about 35 killer whales that came in. And it was interesting that the way that sperm whales have evolved to deal with predation, in this case by killer whales, is that they form a rosetta. Often the calves, which are the most vulnerable, will be in the center, and the females will put their heads into the center and tails outward to try to thwart off the attack. And so clearly these are encounters that they've had over time, so they have evolved strategies here to try to protect themselves, but most notably to try to protect their calves, which would be the most vulnerable and easiest for killer whales to take down. But does it appear that when you're in the open ocean, when in essence there's no bottom you can force or shoreline to push an animal into, that it's going to take larger numbers to contain and to have a coordinated attack? And as a result, if you've got large numbers, you're going to have to take down larger species so that everyone gets a benefit from the hunt.
I'm curious what's at stake in this. I mean, what would it mean to the scientific or conservation communities if it turns out that, let's say, you are able to get the DNA from the living needle in the haystack, the moving needle in the haystack, and you find that this is a distinct population? How significant would that be? What would that mean?
I guess as a scientist, what we kind of live for are the aha moments. We love to be the first to make a new discovery. We share with a few people in our lab, and then we start to talk about it more openly. But it's always exciting to find something that we didn't expect, and particularly when we're finding out things about topics such as killer whales, where one might assume by now we must know everything about them. I think this also points out that the open ocean is literally our last frontier on the planet, and there's still so much more to be discovered. There are species still to be discovered, and it's really exciting, but it's also a very expensive part of the planet to go to learn about it. But it does tell us that, in this case, the fact that the ocean's top predator is making an honest living out there, that it is clearly a very productive part of the world, part of the ocean, and there's more there for us to discover and learn about, and ultimately to protect it. As an example, we're hearing a lot of talk about ocean mining, dredging the bottom. And that could cause huge effects through the entire ecosystem, and ultimately have an impact on killer whales. So I think in some respects, the world does pay attention to species like killer whales or top predators, and it's often through the eyes of a killer whale we begin to appreciate the entire ecosystem or the food pyramid that exists there. And it makes people more aware, and ultimately people care more, and I think will then voice their opinions about how we want to see the oceans developed and used, because ultimately we need to be concerned about all the species that live there.
Andrew Trites, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Andrew Trites is the director of the Marine Mammal Research Unit. He is a professor in the Institute for the Oceans and Fisheries at the University of British Columbia. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to sit down with the poet and essayist Amy Nazuka-Metadl. Her latest book, World of Wonders, draws connections between her astonishment in the natural world and the details of her own life. If you don't want to miss any of our shows, you can listen on the NPR app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get your podcasts. Our nightly rebroadcast is at 8 p.m. Thanks very much for tuning in to Think Out Loud on OPB and KLCC. I'm Dave Miller. We'll be back tomorrow.
Think Out Loud is supported by Steve and Jan Oliva, the Rose E. Tucker Charitable Trust, Michael, Kristen, Andrew Kern, and Anna Sanford.